The Economist.
My parents tell me that this is the year they're going to start getting rid of stuff. Like pretty much every family home, any house occupied for decades, theirs is pretty well packed. And they've always seemed weirdly, perhaps morbidly, aware of their own mortality. So they want to thin things out, put stuff on eBay, join the kind of neighborhood-wide garage sale that regularly happens, so that in the future, I don't have to, or I have less of it to do anyway. We'll see. My colleague, Rosie Blaw, hasn't been lucky that way, so she's been doing something that I absolutely dread. But, as is the journalist's way with these things, she's chosen to try to ask questions, to learn something, to make sense of it. I'm Jason Palmer, and this is The Weekend Intelligence. Most people will at some point face the prospect of clearing out their parents' stuff. It's like a trip down memory lane that you'd choose not to take if you could. In today's episode, Rosie chronicles the sorting of her family home after her mom's death, the tears of laughter, sadness, and sheer frustration that are part of the ride.
Yeah, so we've got some boxes here and some bicycles that have... Oh, I remember that bicycle. That was my bicycle because I can see the little things on the back. But I don't think I would have ridden that since I was about seven. This is cool. They've said they've got a little bag on the back so you can carry things. Gosh, I haven't seen that in such a long time. And some stickers...
Just before Christmas, I got a phone call. Someone was at my mother's front door. They knew Mum was home, but they couldn't rouse her. I called a locksmith and an Uber. When I made it into Mum's house, she was on the floor by her bed. She'd had a stroke, a massive bleed in her brain. 2 weeks later, in the early days of 2024, Mum died.
It's very shocking. It's only 8 weeks. Like, I'm still eating oranges that she bought for herself. You know, they're still good, and that seems really weird that I'm still eating food she bought for me, fresh food that she bought for me. So yeah, it's really quick. It's really surreal.
How old was she?
She was 86.
There's a lot to come to terms with in the wake of losing your mum, knowing you won't ever get to see her or hug her again. My dad died in 2010. It will take time to process the grief of having no parents. But this podcast is not about that loss. Instead, it's an attempt to document the one giant practical thing my brothers and I had to deal with right after Mum died: clearing the family home and a lifetime of our parents' possessions. Mum was something of a hoarder, so for me and my two brothers, the task, which is very much ongoing, is a daunting one.
Brother finding all these bags of leather, and it's like, what did you need anymore? So yeah, or realizing that you sort of thought you'd kind of finished something, and then you just like you look up, you realize there's so much more. So yeah,
I'm in the living room of Mum's 1960s house in London with my producer Sam. It feels extremely weird to invite a colleague to my childhood home, and just weeks after Mum died. It's all pretty exposing. In the weeks since her death, I've had to tell a lot of people what's happened, particularly because the end was so sudden. When friends and colleagues ask how I'm doing, it often seems more manageable to talk instead about the chaos of Mum's possessions. And I've been struck by how many people I've talked to about Mum's house have similar anecdotes about clearing their own parents' or grandparents' homes. All of us, one day, will be faced with the detritus of our loved ones' lives.
I feel very lucky that I've had my brothers here to help me with it, and I think it's really tough. You know, a couple of friends are only children, and I've already said, I will come and help you when you need to do it.
Yeah.
Because you sort of need...
Oh, I mean, it's like... It's so much work, but yeah. Also, like, it's
it's an emotional cathartic process as much as it is a physical task of putting things away. So, like, you know, sorting through a bag of clothes, if I were to sort through these clothes, it might take me 5 minutes. But
right.
for you to sort through these clothes, it could take you 2 hours, because you want to kind of, like, if it's your final goodbye with an item.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's, you know, it would sort of... There's been some really, really funny moments and really lovely moments. And then suddenly you're just in tears because there was this person and you can totally envisage them. It's emotionally exhausting. It's physically tiring, actually, because there's a lot of sorting.
I started the clearing by going through Mum's wardrobe because I knew there weren't many things I'd be able to keep and wear. But as Sam pointed out, it was emotionally exhausting. Mum's clothes were the summation of so much anticipation, so many imaginings. And now I had to start stripping hangers, taking tissues out of pockets, and putting memories into black bags. It felt like I was putting her life in the bin. Right after Mum died, it seemed like an urgent task to go through as much of the house as possible before returning to work. My brothers and I spent 10 long, surreal days ploughing through our parents' lives. Even taking a few minutes off to make a cup of tea felt indulgent. Then, every so often, one of us would come across something so amazing we had to show the others. I found a beautiful photo of Mum, probably aged 21, looking more glamorous but also more put together than I'd ever seen her. My primary school sweatshirt, I could still get into it. And a classic pair of my brother's 1970s blue and yellow swimming trunks, name tape intact and a badge on the front. Distance award, 10 metres. But it wasn't all treasured memories and lovely objects to remind us of our childhood.
It was so incredibly frustrating. But, you know, amongst the things that I found since she died was unopened mail from the 1960s, which means she moved to this house with unopened mail, which she never opened.
Mum was the homemaker, given to collapsing into uncontrollable laughter, which Dad never really approved of. He was more serious and spent a lot of time at his desk. One thing that brought them together, though, was that they both loved a bargain. So I knew we were going to have a massive amount of sorting to do whenever Mum died.
Things. Any cheque you wrote was eventually sent back to you. Mm. So all this unopened mail included like all the cheques she'd ever written for anything. Sort of incredible stuff, but just extraordinary amounts.
But still, I never expected that so many of my questions about them and so much emotion would be bound up with all these belongings. So as I contemplate yet another weekend churning through Mum and Dad's possessions, I can't help wondering, how did my parents manage to accumulate so much? And why did they never throw anything away?
That is a badminton racket. Squash racket. But look at this. This is a really old tennis racket in a wooden press. Haven't actually taken it out. I mean, like, as far as I know, neither of my parents played tennis during my lifetime.
Yeah.
So this must be pretty old.
The quantity of items Mum had amassed in her 86 years was overwhelming. Here's just a tiny sample. There was a pair of Dartington crystal avocado dishes, a guarantee for a Russell Hobbs kettle from 1969, a long plait of Mum's teenage hair, and a small jar labelled Zani's toenail. Zani was the pet dachshund Mum grew up with.
Yes, one of the things that's amazing actually going through this house is how much stuff is made in England. That was a present from a neighbour.
I found 38 margarine containers with 47 lids, 22 empty bottles from contact lens solution, though she stopped wearing contacts in the early 1990s, more than 200 shower caps, piles of those cardboard rectangles that keep a pack of tights flat, and a badge that said Free Kuwait, dating from the first Gulf War in 1990. And it wasn't just her possessions. For a long time after Dad died, Mum continued to lay out two sets of towels in the bathroom. Now we had to confront his belongings too.
I love this.
Oh, this is great. Yes, so my dad was really into these very small clocks and calculators. Both Mum and Dad really liked them. But Dad would often kind of carry...
What made it even slower was that we needed to open or feel every item, because it turned out that Mum liked to hide things. Her spare keys were pinned into the pocket of a navy cardigan halfway down a pile of clothes on a bedroom chair. I found a string of pearls in a bag of knitting. She hid a brooch in the lining of the bedroom curtains. My brother discovered another stash at the bottom of a bucket of cleaning supplies. It's worth saying that Mum and Dad weren't such big hoarders that their home was uninhabitable. You wouldn't make a TV show about them. But they were lucky enough to have bought a house in an era when it was affordable. And though they filled the space, the house was accessible, the bills were paid. But you don't have to be a medically certified hoarder to end up with an awful lot of junk on your hands.
I mean, consumption is a really essential part of who we are as a human species. So I think the essential question isn't so much when people start to consume, because they've always consumed. If you don't consume, you die. Even in a cave, you need to consume certain things.
Frank Trentman is a man who has spent most of his working life thinking about stuff and how, as societies, we come to amass it and value it. Frank's a historian and a writer, and when I read his book, Empire of Things, I knew he was the person to talk to about my parents.
I think the crucial question is about the character or the quality of consuming and how we think about those acts of consuming.
I'd always thought of consumer society, the idea of keeping up with the Joneses, as being a particularly post-war phenomenon, a period when there was suddenly the tech to produce a lot of cheap goods and the desire and means on the part of people like my mum and dad to collect them. Today, when the average house price in London is over £500,000, it's crazy to think that there was a time when, as newlyweds, you could buy a house big enough to have a basement, which, in my parents' case at least, was mostly dedicated to storing empty boxes. They're so useful, Mum would say. She also kept a whole hoard of other things there, which, apparently, we might one day need. I'd thought that the story of how and why my parents amassed so many things was, in part, to do with the period they lived through. But Frank disagrees.
Austerity, as the British call it, so the years after the Second World War, are very important for creating this illusion that then suddenly in the mid-50s, as there is an economic boom, we see a new era. But actually, if we go back in the interwar years, people consumed a lot. And then if we go further back, we have debates in the 19th century where Americans complain about working class people throwing away what looks like perfectly decent sets of china, plates, crockery to buy something new.
Frank's research shows that humans in every society and throughout history are all consumers in some senses. Trade in silks, spices and sugar date back many centuries. But consumption isn't just about value or wealth. We also use our belongings to convey a message.
Consumption communicates. That's one reason why fashion and clothing is so important in consumer culture. So we signal to people and we can use consuming almost like a radar to classify and categorize people. But equally important, I think, is the psychological importance. So the idea that I know who I am partly through my things, and the things are no longer treated as separate, but as part of my identity.
I had to think about what message my parents might have been conveying. Ask anyone over the age of 40 and they'll remember the plates and glasses kept for best. Mum definitely believed in having all the things you might need for polite society. A posh green coffee pot and matching mugs, the good tablecloth that was hard to clean, fish forks. She also saw her possessions as memories. The sagging, uncomfortable sofa that Dad proposed to her on. The cacophony of magnets on the fridge. She particularly liked ones that were replicas of food. Or the Etruscan souvenir she bought the same day a bird shat on her hair. though maybe it was the rest of us that treasured that memory. So yes, I can see how Mum saw herself through her possessions. The utilitarian category of consumption was extremely well catered for. Dad hoarded penknives, stethoscopes and thousands of ballpoint pens, many of them free from conferences. Mum had seemingly every size of plastic container and foreign phrasebook. They did at least use these, though it wasn't quite clear why they needed so many. But there was also a whole category of items that just sat and sat. They were the ones that really made me sigh when I found them. The racks from a broken dishwasher. Four Paddington Bears that lay untouched in a bin bag for decades. Three pairs of Wellington boots, all already too small for my children. Often, like with the boots, Mum wouldn't be able to find the thing she'd carefully kept for future use. Or she'd present me with mad items like her own voluminous maternity clothes from the 1970s. Given the amount of stuff, some people I spoke to about this mammoth sort-out suggested I get house clearers in to get rid of the lot. But that would have felt like a betrayal. Mum could tell me the story of when and where she'd bought almost everything. I knew she'd hate the idea of strangers rifling through it all.
A lot of consumption isn't about the point of purchase. A lot of consumption lies in the anticipation. So you imagine, if I have this, then next year will be wonderful. So a lot of consuming isn't so much necessarily about having, possessing an item, but having items that give you, Adam Smith would have said, the illusion that you can pursue all sorts of future happy lives.
If, as Frank says, consumption is about imagined need, then that actually makes sense for Mum. She imagined so many scenarios when she just might want a particular item. And over time, even the definition of need shifts.
These umbrellas, I don't even need to unfurl them to know, were free with the Evening Standard. And when I was getting married, in the weird way of like thinking about some eventualities and not others, I remember I was thinking, well, what if it rains? And so Mum, you could go and buy, at one point you could buy an Evening Standard and get an umbrella. So Mum went and bought lots of Evening Standards from lots of different people.
The umbrella is probably the prime example. No one had an umbrella before the 18th century in England. And when Jonas Henway appeared with the umbrella, people made fun of him. Who is this goofball they're parading with this stick and some textile around it? Well, now, if it rains, you expect that at the next tube station, there's a small shop which has a big box with cheap umbrellas for $5.99, which you can then dispose of.
Items that were once luxuries often became almost costless. Of course, it helped if you had your own home to put them in.
I think we'll have to keep some of these things. And I wish I knew the story of more of them. I knew the story of a lot, but not tons. This is amazing. This is a Second World War bomb. It's a shell from a bomb. Piece of incendiary bomb, which fell during the evening of January the 11th, 1941. The bombs were extinguished before any damage was done. So this is a rare thing where Mum actually had a record of what it was. But, I mean, isn't that cool? That's 1941, that's amazing. Yes, I think we have to keep...
The story of my parents' possessions doesn't make sense unless you also know the story of the house. Dad arrived in Britain in August 1939, aged 10, on the last boatload of child refugees from Poland before war broke out a week later. Dad was evacuated almost immediately and spent the war moving from billet to billet, learning to speak a plummy English from the radio rather than copy the Cockney accent of his East End cousins. After the war, he found out that his parents and younger sister had been shot in a Polish forest in 1942. Dad bought his first flat with the £5,000 he was given as restitution for their death. Mum's family were far better off, but Mum herself hated showy things and fuss. She was a secretary at the Medical Research Council. That's how she met my dad, who was a doctor. Their first date was a work function of Dad's, which was typical. Medicine was everything to him, I think because it had given him a future, and he never lost his love and pride in it. Mum, she was far more interested in the people she met than the job she did. But by the time she married Dad in 1968, she was doing well for herself, earning £18, 15 shillings and sixpence a week. They weren't the only ones profiting from the post-war boom. Between 1945 and 1973, wages doubled in real terms. That was a moment in British history when many middle-class newlyweds like them could afford to buy a family home. In 1970, when my parents bought their house, the one I grew up in and the one I'm clearing out now, the average home cost less than three times the average wage. Now it's more than eight times. Frank's case that consumerism predated the post-war boom may be true, but it's also clear that there was something distinct about this time. I'm aware that mine is a story of extraordinary privilege, but my parents weren't the only ones who fell on such a bounty. More and more people were becoming homeowners. They were also filling them with different stuff. Newly invented items their own parents couldn't have imagined. After the war, Britain, along with the rest of Europe, benefited from the rapid diffusion of American technology. Looking around at all the things in my parents' home, plastic containers, post-it notes, deep fat fryers, many of these became far more accessible through the 1960s and 70s. Loads of new items suddenly became available, and people hadn't yet thought about the environmental impact of consumption. But something else happened too. Some of those objects actually changed how we lived and consumed.
Television had a huge appeal, and in 1950, there were probably less than a million people with televisions. But by 1960, over 80% of households in Britain and Northern Ireland had televisions, and that's the licensed ones.
Peter Scott is Professor of International Business History at the University of Reading. He has written about the effect of mass-market consumer goods on British society in the post-war period. One of the biggest changes? The television.
It's one of the defining things of social change in the 20th century, that in 1950, people and families would go into town on the bus, they'd go and see the film and they'd come back. But once television caught on, there was no need to do that.
Talking to Peter, I was reminded how Dad used to talk about buying cheap tickets as a medical student to sit in the gods at the opera. Mum loved the theatre. We found nine sets of opera glasses and binoculars among my parents' things. Yet we almost never went to the theatre as a family. Probably because my parents, like so many others, completely fell in love with television. At one point, Mum even worked at the company that put out ITV programmes for London. Right to the end, Mum would reminisce about the night they stayed up to watch the first moon landing in 1969.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
We used to watch TV as a household. On very special occasions, we were even allowed to eat beef sausages on a picnic rug while watching. You can imagine households up and down the country doing the same, each buying their own domestic paraphernalia rather than sharing a single public space like the cinema. We think of smartphones today as having fundamentally changed how we live. But the television did that for an earlier age. All sorts of consumption followed as TV egged us on to buy shiny, exciting new things advertised on screen. But TV also turned attention inwards. Households became independent consumers of all sorts of entertainment. I found plenty of evidence of my parents doing just that. Stacks of old records, a rip-off of a waterproof Sony Walkman that was not, it turned out, waterproof, an Atari console, and an old Donkey Kong game and watch. So yes, consumption and the collection of goods had been going on for centuries. But for my parents, the post-war boom did, in fact, matter a lot. All of which goes some way to explaining why they acquired so many things, particularly as the family grew. What I still don't understand? Why they hung on to so much of it.
Here are some beautiful relics which were right to be kept, which are the original Fisher-Price. These are lovely, and actually my kids have played with these as well. And it's just, I mean, they're just gorgeous. They're beautifully designed. They're incredibly sturdy.
Yeah.
And like, this stuff, you know, it still plays some of it, I think. Yeah. I mean, it's slow.
It's amazing.
But it's very cool.
Back in the house, in and among her belongings, I realise there's a dimension to this story that's been missing. Nothing I've heard explains why Mum never got rid of anything. And the more I find, the less I understand.
Is that better, Sophie?
Now I can. Yes, that's much better.
Okay, good. Sorry.
Just remind me of your name.
I'm Rosie. Hello.
Rosie. I'm back in my parents' living room. There are 12 boxes of books by the window. I've got a collection of broken watches and alarm clocks on the table beside me. And I've decided to call in some more expert help.
I'm Sophie Holmes, and I'm a consultant clinical psychologist.
Sophie Holmes has spent much of her career helping people who struggle with hoarding.
I'll just explain very quickly sort of what I'm thinking about in terms of this podcast, and then I wanted to ask you a couple of things, and then maybe we can just have a conversation. My mum died in January, beginning of January.
She also knows how difficult it is to have to sort through your parents' life.
Like you, I have lost my mum, and 2.5 years ago. But yeah, I went through clearing, and I have to say it's ongoing because I now have a lot of her stuff here. And I have to also confess that I'm thinking about my own children and what am I going to be leaving them? And I don't particularly want to leave them what I see as a bit of a mess of my mum's stuff.
I asked Sophie what other people say about why they hold on to things.
It was given to me by somebody important. It reminds me of being with somebody important. It reminds me of an event I wanted to go to. Memory stuff, that's all really common. Worries about not wanting to add to landfill, so that if I do throw all these papers out the door, things like toys and teddies can be quite difficult in that sense.
Clearing my parents' house has definitely made me think about my children having to do this for me one day, and that I need to rein in my own desire to keep things that hold memories. I now see that if you treasure too many things, you risk savouring none of them. It's impossible to do this much sorting without thinking about Marie Kondo, the decluttering guru who famously taught us to rid ourselves of unnecessary possessions and only keep things that, to use her words, spark joy. I wonder how that works for clearing through Mum's belongings. What does it even mean to spark joy?
There's been an emphasis on keeping things because they give you joy. And
yes.
I think what you're saying is, in some ways, the much bigger compulsion is to keep things because they give you comfort, which is a different thing.
Well, it is joy. That's joy is a kind of umbrella term for anything that you like or want, isn't it? It's, if you think about it in a very general way, it's joy if you know you're going to use it, you're going to be able to give it to your daughter, you're going to be able to wear it. I mean, all of that is part of why do we keep stuff? And we know why we keep stuff, don't we? We keep stuff because we think it's going to be useful, or it gives us nice feelings and memories, or it's valuable and we might get, you know, we might be able to sell it and help our children in the future with buying houses because we can sell all those teapots.
Joy and memory might be important for some things in my parents' house. Yes, I can see the joy in the flowery apron Mum loved, despite how threadbare it was. But the umbrellas, the dishwasher racks... That doesn't make sense to me. So many of these items were useless, unused, or both.
Probably both my parents started, you know, not throwing things away somewhat earlier in their life.
As children. And you could surmise that that may have been because of the importance of holding on to things, because there was very little, or there was a lot of loss, or both. And, you know, when you think about what you've talked about with your dad, that seems really significant, you know, to lose his home country, his family, his culture, everything that he's known and loved has gone. It wouldn't be at all surprising to think he might have some reservations about disposal of stuff and maybe overvalue things because of that experience.
That would be an easy explanation. Dad was a refugee. He didn't really talk about his experiences or his parents. But it would have made sense if, having lost so much, he ended up getting attached to all the material goods he later acquired. Except I know that isn't quite right. Yes, both my parents were at it, as my brother puts it. But it was Mum who was the far bigger hoarder.
So how that seems to be somewhat common, that people should hoard without it becoming this kind of sort of physical inability.
Yeah, well, there's some quite classic differences between people who hoard and people who collect. But I see it on a continuum. I do think that, you know, things can get quite out of hand for people who collect. So typically the person who hoards isn't able to keep it organised. And typically the person who collects does. So that, you know, you can see there's a bit of a grey area there between your, you know, you're sitting in your parents' house, I think, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, I can see walls. I don't see boxes piled high. I don't know if that's because you've cleared, but, it, you know, there is something about we can have a table that we can't use, but we can still use the cooker.
For people who have the tendency towards the hoarding end of that continuum, which I think Mum did, Sophie sees this as rooted in more basic fears and anxieties.
So we can all catastrophise, can't we? If, you know, if I don't leave on time, I won't get to the school and pick my children up. They'll hate me. They'll think I don't love them. The teachers will think I'm a terrible mum. Versus if I get there late, they'll hold the kids and it'll be fine.
Talking to Sophie starts to make me think about Mum's experience in a slightly different way. Mum hadn't lost her family, but she'd lived through the war, and like most people of her generation in Britain, and many more in Europe and beyond, that probably shaped her responses to many aspects of everyday life thereafter. Like Dad, Mum was a pre-war baby, born in 1937, when her own mother was just 19. Her father went off to fight in the war, and her mother joined the Mechanized Transport Corps. So in 1942, aged 5, Mum was sent away to boarding school. Her school reports talked of nervousness and diffidence. She saw her father only once between the age of 2 and 8. She talked about the war far more than Dad did, reminiscing about how disgusting whale meat sausages and powdered eggs were, or laughing about the time the family's pet dachshund ate the week's butter ration. She remembered her father bringing home a banana from the war, and it was never quite clear which she treasured most, the exotic fruit or the man she barely knew. She wasn't poor, and she wasn't starving. But after speaking to Sophie, various things that I'd laughed at when I first found them at Mum's house suddenly took on a different complexion. A booklet advising the householder on protection against nuclear attack. Recipes for how to cook with rations. Candle wax melted down into old tobacco tins with pieces of string for wicks, ready for the power cuts of the 1970s. There was a leaflet from 1999, what everyone should know about the millennium bug. By the loo stood giant Ribena bottles filled with water in case the mains water was shut off. Home wasn't just a haven, It contained every weapon, every tool she might need for whatever life had to throw at her family. In some ways, my routine now isn't so different from when Mum was alive. I still go to her house every week, and I still feel bad if I don't have time. Her belongings often evoke the same combination of emotions in me that Mum herself did for so long. Love and delight, sadness, frustration. I laugh at the madness and brilliance of Mum for having kept the train candle holders that adorned every childhood birthday cake. And I know she would have been delighted that at her funeral, my nephews were all wearing coats that hadn't been taken off their hangers this century. I feel a pang of sadness as I open the linen cupboard, and it smells the same as it always has. I know that can't last much longer. And then I reach up and find more empty pill bottles, and I'm frustrated all over again, incredulous that I'm having to pore over things that should have been binned years ago. Yet maybe I do understand Mum after all, and perhaps I always did. While the stuff is there at her home, so is the world that my parents inhabited and imagined. Sorting through Mum and Dad's belongings is as close as I will ever again get to seeing the world through their eyes. Mum found it comforting to have those things, and though in some ways I want it all dealt with, and I need it to be done, that mass of stuff is also comforting to me. I get to be in Mum's presence for just a little bit longer.
That's all for this episode of The Weekend Intelligence. Thanks for listening. Please do keep checking in every Saturday for our very best storytelling. This week's episode was reported by Rosie Blaw and produced by Sam Westren. Sound design by Carla Patella, and Gemma Newby is the show's executive producer. We'll see you back here on Monday.